Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Cairo, Egypt, for an update on the violent clashes between the angry supporters of ousted President Morsi and the military that toppled him. A political activist engaged in the first and now the second revolution underway, Sherif Geber, a member of the Morrisine Independent Media Collective, joins us to explain the battles in the streets and the prospects for a restoration of Egyptian democracy with all sides participating. Then we will speak with Steve Clemens, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. We will discuss the recent close vote on stopping the NSA from spying on Americans and the apparent gulf between the public and the political establishment on the government's intrusion into our civil liberties. We will also discuss the fate of Edward Snowden and whether the White House is using the cancellation of Obama's September visit to Russia as leverage to get Putin to hand over Snowden. And then finally, we'll speak with Tom Herschel, a professor of sociology at Cornell University and director of the Population and Development Program. We will discuss a new report that he worked on for the Associated Press that finds 4 out of 5 U.S. adults struggling with joblessness and near poverty in an economy in which Obama says the income gap is fraying America's social fabric. And joining us now from Cairo is Sherif Geber, who's a member of the Morrisine Independent Media Collective in Cairo, where he researches housing rights and social justice issues. And you are in the midst, of course, of Revolution 2, and there was an enormous amount of violence last night, particularly on the October 6th bridge, where a number of supporters of the ousted President Morsi left their encampment in Nasser City, marched towards the city, and then there was a shootout. I guess most of the shooting obviously came from the army and the police. They claim, of course, that some of the Islamists shot at them, but there are over 70 people killed. So this is beginning to look like Egypt's future is looking increasingly dark.
I think that we have to remember that this isn't the first time that security forces have perpetrated an atrocity like this. Of course, the scale here is huge. It's one of the biggest instances of violence we've seen from police. But then again, you know, it's not the first time that police or army have just free-fired on demonstrators. It's definitely troubling. I mean, in some ways, we've been feeling, many of us, that we're caught between military fascism and brotherhood fascism for some time now. But at the same time, I think the truth will come out, and I think that we are going to have to continue, because there's really to fall into the trap of either kind of cowering behind the military or jumping to raise the brotherhood up as heroes simply because they've been so heinously attacked, I think is nothing that we need to do politically. We need to continue on rejecting this kind of cycle of state violence that the Brotherhood used just as much as the army is now using when they were in power, and agitating for alternative futures.
Well, isn't that the irony, though, here, Sherif Geber, that Mohamed Morsi has been transformed from a tone-deaf, incompetent, boneheaded leader to a hero of the Islamic cause?
I think that he remains a tone-deaf and incompetent leader. But the Islamists, particularly the Brotherhood, had always supported him and always denied the allegations of his incompetency. And I think that it's very easy to oppose what happened and oppose this sort of police violence without raising up Morsi or the Muslim Brotherhood as heroes or as anyone who warrants our support beyond seeing that the police isn't allowed to attack them in the street.
But Sherif Geber, the protesters that poured into Tahrir Square yesterday, hundreds of thousands, were holding up portraits of their favorite general, General Sisi. So he appears to be a hero amongst many. Now, you're a part of the younger generation who brought about the original revolution. Is this an awkward bedfellow that you have?
He's no bedfellow at all, I'd say. I mean, the people who came into Tahrir Square raising portraits of Sisi, many of them, of course, were scared by the kind of propaganda and media frenzy that turned the Brotherhood from, you know, as we saw, a very violent and incompetent party ruling the country into some sort of boogeyman. I mean, this is an intentional move by the army and by military intelligence to raise up Sisi as a kind of charismatic figure, although I don't see where the charisma comes from. So I think that a lot of people are doing this out of hatred of the Brotherhood, whether that's rational or contributed to by the way that the media has been really shamefully behaving. And on the other hand, we, you know, those of us who've been fighting out in the streets for this revolution over the past 2.5 years have very few illusions about the military, about the military's true goals, and about the military's true position as a core and enormous part of the old regime that itself cannot be allowed to continue the way it is. And I should think that the current fervor aside, we have to come out of this opposing both, again, the Brotherhood and the military in order to really see the change that I think everyone in Egypt truly wants.
And again, I'm speaking with Sharif Geber, who is in Cairo, Egypt. He's a member of the Mousserine Independent Media Collective, where his work and research focuses on housing rights and social justice issue. And we're talking about the second revolution underway, and particularly the violence that was meted out against a demonstration of supporters of the imprisoned leader, Mohamed Morsi, of course, ironically, the first democratically elected leader of Egypt, who a large part of the population rejected, and the army brought about a coup. Of course, many people don't want to call it a coup, but I've been trying to cover what was behind this takeover. And you remember, of course, when Sisi announced the takeover, he was standing next to representatives of the Al-Nur party, the Salafists, the very conservative Islamists. So where does that stand now, the alliances here? You've got on the moderate side, for the want of a better description, you've got Mohamed al-Baradei condemning the excessive use of force. Al-Nur appears to be very silent. And I guess the broader question is the role of Saudi Arabia in funding this latest revolution. So is it possible, Sharif, that the young revolutionaries like yourself are going to have the revolution stolen again?
Well, you know, I think that to say that we've had one revolution or two, or to say that we've had a revolution stolen in its entirety is a misnomer. I mean, we've been involved, I think, in one very long revolutionary sequence that began on the 25th of January in 2011, if not sooner, and has continued. We've seen the army, yes, definitely, attempting to co-opt popular energies and play on people's fears and use their own strength to bully people into accepting their role in power and politics. But to say that they've entirely stolen it is not true, because we saw people come out, continue to demonstrate against military rule, and we will see that again. We saw people demonstrating against the Brotherhood. I mean, there is an opposition that will continue until the demands of the revolution are met, because these are basic social justice demands that, you know, people won't stop until they see a substantive change happening in their daily lives, you know, dignity, freedom, and social justice. And, you know, as far as the Salafis go, you know, the Nur party is just one of the most incredible opportunists that I've seen. I mean, they've entered into this, I think, under the notion that some Islamists would be able to help the coalition keep legitimacy, but at the same time, they're acting as spoilers, and I think that they don't really have any interest in the revolution. They simply have an interest in kind of recouping the power that the Muslim Brotherhood lost. So I don't see much of a future for them, whether it's even within the coalition, which they're continually spoiling, or, you know, hopefully in Egypt's politics, because they don't represent a way forward and a real change in the economy or in our daily life.
But apparently before this coup, there were tremendous shortages, gasoline shortages, long lines, bread, etc. And there is an assumption that because suddenly $12 billion appeared from the Gulf and from Saudi Arabia, The Saudis were the first to congratulate Sisi. Gasoline suddenly showed up in the gas stations, and the police, who have never been on the streets for the longest time, suddenly show up and start directing traffic. So one can have a suspicion that there's an outside role in this as well. How much do you feel there is an outside role between, you know, in a way, a proxy role between the Qataris who supported the Muslim Brotherhood and through Al Jazeera, which is apparently quite unpopular in Egypt, and then the Saudis, who apparently were sabotaging the economy and now are rewarding the generals?
Well, you know, we had gasoline shortages, I mean, historically, once every once in a while. You know, they were nothing new, and I wouldn't adopt necessarily conspiratorial tone about that. And we've definitely seen Qatar on the one hand and Saudi Arabia on the other hand throwing money at their favored side as part of a proxy battle. But in the end, you know, they're supporting very reactionary elements, whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood or the old regime. You know, the Egyptian people aren't seeing this money or gaining the benefit of it. And I think that they're suspicious of it in either case. You know, so we're, of course, Egypt has a long history of imperialism working against it, and a long history of being a site of many proxy battles in the Middle East, particularly as relates to maintaining a certain status quo relationship with Israel for the U.S.'s sake. But, you know, we at the same time, I think, are going to have to continue to push for kind of independence on a revolutionary course. And, you know, daunting as the task may be, you know, I think it's the only way that we can continue to go, whether or not the kind of proxies wage.
So you've got, on the one hand, you've got an angry and dejected Muslim Brotherhood, whose leader has been imprisoned by this coup, and they seem to represent certainly the less economically advantaged Egyptians. And on the other side, you've got the generals who've always been around, and then you've got the Mubarak-era media that you were mentioning earlier. I imagine that's what you're referring to, that is demonizing the Brotherhood. So at this point, Sharif Geber, how do you see this thing being resolved? Because it, surely at the end of the day, the Muslim Brotherhood supporters have to be invited back into the democratic process. You can't have a repeat of what happened in Algeria. A lot of the Islamists believe that they will be excluded from democracy, and that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy if you believe in that adage that the Islamists only believe in one man, one vote, one time. That becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy if you deny them the democratic process. And after all, there's been a coup against their democratically elected leader.
I mean, sure. I mean, this is definitely the case. But to say that there's been a coup is not the same as saying that, you know, Morsi was a legitimate leader and the Muslim Brotherhood had legitimate rule. I mean, from the very beginning, we saw that the elections themselves took place under the military junta and, you know, were done in a questionable fashion and rushed, I think, to give this exact appearance of formal democratic procedure without really creating any change in the regime so as to make it a democratic system in a substantive way. I mean, and this is these are open questions, and the Muslim Brotherhood's own intransigence has definitely deepened the crisis, as have the military's sort of half-hearted calls for reconciliation. I think what we need to see is serious transitional justice. I think what we need to see is accountability for past crimes from all sides, but particularly the police and the army. The police, for instance, have really not even had to answer for the over 800 people killed in a single day, January 28, 2011, much less any of the other incidents of just gross and extreme violence we've seen, and same with the army. So this is something that I think, you know, if this government, this new government, is to show itself having any worth, it has to focus on a transitional justice project immediately. And unfortunately, it seems that they're just being puppeted by the military. So, you know, it could get it could get ugly before it gets better, unfortunately. But we have to keep pushing for what's right. This is a matter of principle and a matter of not siding with someone who is ultimately an enemy.
But how do you proceed then, Sherif Geber? If it's one group demonstrating in the streets, hundreds of thousands in favor of the generals, and hundreds of thousands in favor of the jailed Brotherhood leader Morsi, that is just a recipe for more street violence and more death. So what's happening in the alternative arena of negotiation? So you obviously can't negotiate with street demonstrations, tear gas, and shootings. There has to be an alternative form of negotiation, compromise and getting together and meeting. So give us a sense of where we're heading here. Are there any moves towards, you know, political compromise as opposed to a military confrontation?
I mean, you know, the civilian government, for whatever it's worth, has not really, has ostensibly been moving in this direction. But I think beyond that, I think what many of us are trying to do now is to find, to create initiatives that do expose the lies and the kind of violations from both sides, and at the same time push for a sort of third way, something that doesn't want to see return to either the Muslim Brotherhood or military rule, but at the same time wants to bring back, you know, basically all Egyptians and return this to the field of kind of political debate and political conflict. I mean, if you're asking me for specific mechanisms, this is something that, you know, we've been basically trying to just stay afloat of what's been happening. As you said, we're dealing with large numbers on either side, and we're dealing with a police force and an army who are kind of incredibly emboldened right now. But we have started small in the past. The movement against the military junta began with only a handful of people in 2011 and ended up kind of sweeping the country after a long period of organization and work. And so, you know, it is going to be similarly a time to attempt to invest and build in sort of any number of new initiatives to see which ones will stick and which ones will gain momentum. And I think that as each side, both the kind of intransigent and unpopular Muslim Brotherhood, and as that kind of army show their true colors and continue to deepen this crisis, people will be accepting alternatives, and people will want to see us moving back towards a real civilian revolutionary path.
And is the umbrella for that movement, is that still Tamarod? Is that, because that was financed by some of these big media oligarchs, wasn't it?
Well, you know, this did come out, but Tamarod actually, I mean, Tamarod started as a real, true grassroots movement. And I don't know the extent to which, I mean, you know, someone like Naguib Soweto to claim that he financed them, you know, is an arrogant man by nature, being the richest man in Egypt. And so I'm sure that in part he was trying to kind of just capitalize on the popularity of the campaign. And I'm sure he gave some money, but, you know, to say that he financed it, I think they had an office, and then they were printing out flyers. You know, this is a question. But also, Tamarod, we saw, has in many ways jumped on the pro-military bandwagon and collaborated with the military in ways that I think has turned off a lot of people who supported the original campaign. So it might not be Tamarod, but it might be other people like them. You know, it is similarly, I think, has to happen. Tamarod was totally unknown until they're collecting signatures on a university campus and were attacked by Brotherhood members. You know, this happens by accident as much as it does by preparation and intention. So we can't necessarily predict what will be the thing that catches on, but we can continue to work in different arenas to push for new campaigns and for new initiatives to start, of which some of them already have, and we'll see the amount of momentum that we can build beneath them.
Well, Sherif Geber, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for being here.
Again, I've been speaking with Sharif Graber, who is a member of the Muracine Independent Media Collective in Cairo, where he researches on housing rights and social justice issues. He participated in the original revolution 2 years ago and in the subsequent revolution, which continues, as he pointed out. It is a long process, and it's worth remembering that the American Revolution didn't happen overnight as well, Sharif. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you again.
We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Steve Clemens about the fate of Edward Snowden. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Steve Clemens, who is a Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation and previously served as executive director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Clemens.
My pleasure, Ian.
And Steve, I wanted to talk to you about the recent close vote on stopping the NSA from spying on Americans and the apparent gulf between the public and the political establishment on the government's intrusion into our civil liberties, and also, of course, touch on the fate of Edward Snowden and whether the White House is using the cancellation of Obama's September visit to Russia as leverage in getting Putin to hand over Snowden. So there's the menu for today, Steve.
It's a nice plate of things. I mean, I really think that the vote that was held on the funding of the NSA after this and how close it came to winning is a really interesting barometer reading of how concerned many Americans are that so much of their private data is being amassed by a government agency. And Justin Amasha, a Republican, someone I happen to know and admire, 33-year-old Republican from Dearborn, Michigan, and has been active really in the Republican Party in knocking back some of the, you know, anti-Muslim and racist elements of some of the Republican Party. I admire him on many of those fronts. Nonetheless, almost got away with this extraordinary amendment that Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner both had to get out and personally whip votes to try and stop him and what he was trying to propose. So with almost no debate and, you know, just the knee-jerk reactions of many people are very concerned about this, about what the NSA is doing. And while many people are saying, hey, you know, he lost and that shows where the, you know, will of the public is, I don't see that at all. I see it as rather a strengthening of the position that many people want to see the powers of the National Security Agency curtailed.
And it would seem that the Edward Snowden story has been sidetracked largely by his personal saga, traveling around the world and being a fugitive and all that's taken place in Moscow, etc., has taken all of our eyes off the ball. And that is, of course, what he originally revealed. And the president himself did call for this debate. And obviously...
Well, I guess I have mixed feelings about it. I may see it a little differently than you do. When Snowden actually revealed himself in that extraordinary 15-minute exchange with Glenn Greenwald, when they went back and forth, I was actually mentioned in it because there were mention of some Twitter comments. I didn't know Snowden. I hadn't known he was going to reveal himself, but there was a back and forth set of comments on my Twitter that got an awful lot of attention at that time. And I did think at that time that people would get lost and distracted by the story of this young man who is a sort of Daniel Ellsberg of today, in a way, rather than the broader, deeper issues of how much of our, you know, our liberties have been rolled back by the expansion of official secrecy and the expansion of powers of the presidency. And while the president called for the debate, you know, today there was a powerful piece by Mark Udall and Ron Wyden, two senators who've been active in this, basically saying, you know, we need to have this debate. We need to keep the NSA from gathering all of this data. So I sort of see the debate going on, but there has been a benefit of the Snowden affair. You know, you're in the media. You know how fickle the media is in covering things. Snowden's ongoing purgatory right now, sitting over in a Russian airport, has kept this story alive a lot longer than I thought it would be. And I do think that it's contributing to the notion that there needs to be a debate. And as time has gone on, more and more Americans have seen him not as a traitor, but more as a whistleblower. I have mixed views about Snowden. I think that he went over the line and some of the things that he revealed, but I think that he is, you know, very important and, you know, counts in the book where I would put Daniel Ellsberg, which is a hero on revealing the NSA element of their tracking, you know, American citizens, data in communication. So I think that his being out there is part distraction, but it's also part continuing the story in the news, because believe me, the White House would really like this story to go away so they can get on to other things, and they don't want to have this debate.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Clemens, who is the Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also Senior Fellow and Founder of the American Security Program of the New America Foundation, and previously served as Executive Director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California, and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. Well, initially, though, of course...
You say all that so well. Big mouthful.
You know, when it first came out, the story first came out, of course, Booz Allen Hamilton, which is the contractor that Snowden worked for, it's in turn owned by the Carlyle Group, which is the ultimate in insiders. And the whole idea of 70% of our intelligence budget being privatized with these opaque government, these opaque corporate entities, and the enormous amount of money that's going to us, I'm beginning to see a sort of repeat of the Cold War in the sense that during the Cold War, deterrence itself became kind of a racket because there was never enough deterrence, and therefore the military-industrial complex got a blank check, more submarines, more planes, more missiles, etc., and it just went on and on and on. And it seems to me that in the information age, we have a similar conundrum where there's not enough information. There can never be enough information, particularly precise information of the kind that the NSA is looking for. So do you think that we have created a monster here?
Well, I've been arguing for many years that we have been, that the expansion of secrecy and the expansion of a national security state in response to what was defined, I think, wrongly as a global war on terrorism. I said, this is the threat that we'll keep giving because there's no end to it. Terrorism is a tactic, but people will always be able to point to something. And this was perfectly tuned into what we used to call the missile gap, or used to call, you know, the threat inflation from the Soviet Union at the time, where the Soviets were far less capable, their economy far less robust, that the vector for their nation was much less concerning, you know, if you had a substantive read. And so we were overanalyzing that threat and then trying to meet it in the United States. Now you can look back and see how, you know, what the gap in that was. And so I worried a lot that, you know, a kind of fear-mongering approach that I think that the Bush and Cheney administration took, which I think the Obama administration in many ways has maintained, unfortunately, has, you know, created a situation where anything that the government wanted to do is justified. Now, I think there are people in government like Chuck Hagel and others who really don't see the world that way and would like to see gravity come back into the national intelligence and the national military space. But we've been off on a binge where we have been doing this. And on the privatization side, you know, I don't know if that's Cold War-like, but I do have a lot of concerns that the notion that you can take so many of the roles and functions that were in the private military space or the intelligence space, privatize them, and you think you're getting more efficiencies. We've just seen basically, you know, you're familiar with Japan. In Japan in the old days, they would, you know, have something called descent from heaven, so that amakudari, that after you worked in the Japanese government for most of your life, you would go off to a position in private industry that was made available to you as a cushy job. We've created an amakudari or a descent for heaven for generals that basically retire from the military and they go into extremely well-paid private contracting positions overseeing many individuals who have retired from or who have left the military as well, who are playing the same role they were in the military but at twice or three times the pay. And so this hasn't created efficiencies. It's actually not necessarily enhanced, you know, America's military strength, reach, or capabilities, but it's made it all an awful lot more expensive, and it's given us a way to reward, I think, you know, too nicely in my book, many people who have retired from the military service. That's why we've contracted so much into the private side. That is not Cold War-like. That's just structural corruption.
Right. Well, obviously, there's no shortage in Washington of trading public service for private gain. But surely the worst part of it is that if you have generals in the office, in either in the Pentagon or at the head of the NSA, which always has a four-star as its head, and McConnell was the four-star at the head of NSA for some time, and now he's at Booz Allen Hamilton, the contractor that Snowden worked for. So it was while McConnell was there at NSA that I think you have the worst possibility of corruption, because, you know, you could be feathering your nest for the next job. And there have been a couple of whistleblowers, Thomas Drake and William Binney, who've talked about massive programs that were just huge boondoggles, up to $8 billion being wasted on one called Trailblazer. And Hayden, of course, went from the NSA to head up the CIA, and I'm sure he's got plenty of office in the private sector. So isn't that the problem? It's not so much where they go afterwards, it's what they do when they're in office, in not being watchdogs for the public interest, but maybe looking ahead for a new corporate sponsor.
Well, I agree with everything you said, but you know, I have this view of government that sometimes gets me into trouble with my progressive friends. I know Mike McConnell, I know Mike Hayden, I know other that have been substantially significant in the intelligence world. And they have built a labyrinth of institutions with enormous capacities. And, you know, while you can look for the $8 billion failures, you can also see they've amassed an incredible machine that is Orwellian and that has unbelievable capacity to run all sorts of electronic communications through it. We're debating one element of that in terms of what they can do domestically in the United States, but they've built something that really works. And to a certain degree, it's not entirely their job to be warm and fuzzy defenders of democracy. That job belongs to a smarter president, and it belongs to a judicial branch of government that supposedly through FISA courts was supposed to manage this, but largely became a rubber stamp. And it belongs to Congress, where, you know, you've got people like Ron Wyden and Mark Udall who've been, you know, whistling in the dark, you know, very much alone, where members of Congress, and I think, have been derelict in their duty and applying oversight. I have a view of government as one that is a ferocious struggle among branches of government. And the fact is, the legislative branch and the judicial branch have poorly served Americans, and they've not been doing their role to curtail this power. So the NSA will never, ever roll back its own capabilities. And people need to understand this, that while I'm concerned about the NSA and I'm very publicly out there in terms of what they've done and I'm opposed to it, nonetheless, I don't view it as their role to do this. They've kind of, you know, gone on this boondoggle and they've been doing this. We need the other branches of government to come in with appropriate oversight, but there is no oversight. Dana Priest, the Pulitzer Prize winning a writer from the Washington Post who did such a great job in revealing the secret prisons in Europe and won the Pulitzer Prize, that is also someone who in the last couple of years has done some of the best articles out there on what she calls the intelligence industrial complex that has become super large, sprawling, and beyond anyone's ability to really look at. We have a problem in this country, and you know, the NSA is never going to roll back its own power. We have to. You've got to get other people engaged,
sure,
and legislators have to get off their rear ends and actually begin doing what Justin Amash did. That's why what he did was so incredibly impressive. It didn't win, but it's very close to winning. And I think that we're going to potentially get the system back into at least some rollback of these authorities that the NSA has taken.
And indeed, Dana Priest, who you just mentioned, co-authored with Bill Arkin the Top Secret America series for the Washington Post, which was an enormous breakthrough. Remember, back in 2010.
Yeah, that caused a lot of grief in the intelligence community because it was so revealing and so accurate.
Right, and I actually had Bill Arkin out here at the UCLA Hammer last week talking about it, and my head's still reeling from what he told us.
Yeah, I mean, the articles are a bit, you know, a couple years old, but I would go back.
Exactly.
For those interested in this subject can take a look, because it was a nice precursor to everything that we're seeing revealed today,
exactly,
in real time by Snowden and others.
Well, so Steve, you were just saying a minute ago that you're out of step with your progressive friends. I'm certainly about to get out of step with my progressive friends by suggesting that the problem with progressives is that they can't have two thoughts in their head at the same time, and it's quite possible that Snowden is both a hero and a traitor. And, you know, if you watch MSNBC too much, you get kind of tribal about your politics, or equally so on the right, if you watch Fox all the time. And I think there's obviously a lot of nuance here. What's your sense then of what's going on in Moscow? Is Obama in the White House using his September, or the threat of canceling his September trip to Moscow that Putin is very invested in, to get Snowden? Is that going on?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the ultimate outcome between Putin and Obama will be. Putin didn't go to Chicago for the summit that Obama had invited him for. So these things go back and forth. And ultimately, we can make more of that than we should, because Russia and the United States are struggling over Syria, over Iran, over a lot of other issues. And Snowden was a real gift to Putin because I said at the time when people said, you know, is he going to leave? I really doubted he was going to leave the airport. And I just said, look, we have to be careful of, you know, this discussion from WikiLeaks about the flight of liberty. I said, I don't quite buy it. Putin gets a lot of juice out of this. And he pretends to be annoyed, but it actually is a way for him to just play with the United States and play with the president a bit. And so I look at this as a kind of surface, you know, a surface issue that is less deep. But it is uncomfortable for me to have Edward Snowden seeking refuge from illiberal regimes. And I think that is complicated. And I think that, you know, Snowden revealed something that was so important and vital, and I think he was a real hero for it, and I believe he was a whistleblower until he went over the line and began sharing other dimensions of what the NSA can do, because certainly China, Russia, and other governments, Israel, Iran, Great Britain, France, all have significant intelligence establishments that are prying and you know, basically tapping into the infrastructure of the global, you know, communication system. And this is known, it's been out there, but the revelations that Snowden brought, I thought, went beyond the line of public interest of what we as Americans needed to know and should have known. And that's where I think a lot of my friends have been saying this on MSNBC quite a lot, but you know, a lot of my progressive friends have been uncomfortable with, you know, my comments on it. So, but he is a hero on the NSA side, and I do think he ventures into the non-hero side. You might want to call it traitor. Traitor sounds so harsh, but I think that he undermined the interests of the country significantly on these other fronts. And he's now, you know, I don't know where it's going to go in Russia, but when you read the Russian press and you hear what's going on, it sort of seems he's becoming a bit of a hero over there in the Russian press. It'll be interesting to see if Putin ignores that level of fascination in the Russian media and the Russian public for Snowden and then sends him abroad, because Putin may take a political hit for that at home.
Well, Steve Clements, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Steve Clemens, who is the Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation and previously served as Executive Director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with one of the authors of the new Associated Press report that has 4 out of 5 adults in America struggling with joblessness and near poverty. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Herschel, who's the director of the Population and Development Program and a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. He's just published or co-authored a new report at the Associated Press on the widening gap of wealth inequality in the United States, where 4 out of 5 adults are struggling with joblessness and near poverty. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Herschel.
Thanks for inviting me in.
And the new study that you have been in, one of the co-authors of, and there are other authors as well. A lot of research has clearly gone into this, but it does really explode the kind of idea that we've had about how American poverty has been gauged in previous sort of official reports, if you will. So tell us about the methodology here and why all of a sudden your report is indicating that everything we thought about this country is wrong, that we've had an extremely exaggerated and glossy idea about the American dream and the lives of the majority of our citizens. Things are, according to your report, a lot worse than they have been portrayed.
Well, what we did, Ian, was we decided we wanted to put time into our analysis. And so we found a data set on 5,000 families that was maintained for 42 years. And so we observed these 5,000 families as they changed over time, had children, the children stayed in the study. And what we found was that when you track people over time like this, you get a very different impression of what their lives are like. Official data from the Census Bureau, now this is a study that's housed at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. It's a very, very, very well-done data set, very, very good methodology. But when you look over time, you see that it's typical for Americans to encounter at least one year where their family head is unemployed, or where people are in poverty, or where they're relying on a social safety net to get by. And that's surprising because this is not part of the social discourse that we have in the country, where 4 out of 5 Americans are experiencing serious hard times, at least. And of course, many people get it for more than one year. And so, you know, our study kind of encapsulates those kind of statistics.
So the bottom line here is that poverty is not about them, it's about us.
That's correct, that's correct. Poverty is really something that's being driven, I think, by our market society, that, people are maybe doing really well for a few years, things are going well, and then suddenly somebody loses a job, or somebody falls off a roof, or something happens where someone goes in the hospital in the family. And then people tumble, and they have these one or more years of hard times. And I think that as we see the dynamics of the market economy intensifying in the context of, you know, the global crisis, of the financial crisis, and all the things that are going on in the world right now, we really see a need not just for politicians to fix things with policy, but for some kind of new economic system. And I think that economic system really needs to be demanded by the people that are not doing so well. And those are the people that are not really part of the discourse. A lot of the discourse is about people at the top, the celebrities, people making lots of money. That's really what dominates American culture.
But what you've found out in your new study for the Associated Press, Thomas Herschel, is that economic insecurity amongst whites is more pervasive than is shown in the government's poverty data, and it affects more than 76% of white adults by the time they turn 60. Now, what I find extraordinary about that is that, of course, that President Obama has a problem with poor white people in this country, and many don't see themselves as being poor and white. In November, Obama won the votes of just 36% of what's called non-college whites, which is the worst performance since Ronald Reagan's landslide victory over Walter Mondale. This seems to me to be really an interesting irony, isn't it, that the president, who just made an impassioned speech this week saying that he's going to dedicate the rest of his term in office to making America work again for working Americans, and that the people in this country that most dislike this president are the ones that are being most affected by poverty and joblessness, even if they don't recognize it.
That is quite an irony, Ian. I think part of that is just what we could call the politics of race, the fact that the president is black, and that there's, especially in the southern region of the United States, we see a lot of manipulation of voting districts and a kind of politics where race and class and sometimes even religion is thrown in. People get divided along certain lines socially, and they're not able to maybe really see the broader picture of what's happening in the country. And I think there's a history of this that goes back, well, you know, to the beginning of the country, and it really hasn't ended. And I think, in effect, the Supreme Court is really kind of ramping that up with its discrediting of the enforcement procedures of the Voting Rights Act. That this makes that even more likely to happen. This kind of people seeing the country through a racial lens rather than through the lens of their own experience. And I think it's a very serious situation.
And of course, the Trayvon Martin verdict brought that into light and have inflamed that divide. And of course, obviously, it's the idea that somebody got away with murder is very disturbing for a lot of people. Now,
it's very disturbing, especially murder of a child. I mean, that's about the worst thing I can imagine.
Right. So you know, we have there's the economy, and then there's the society, and the president himself, in an interview in Sunday's New York Times, is concerned that the income gap is fraying the U.S. social fabric. He made allusions to racial tensions, etc., in his interview with the New York Times. So they're inextricably bound. In many ways, it would seem that what your report is showing, Thomas Herschel, is that they are a distraction from the economic realities, and that if everybody in this country who's economically disadvantaged woke up and recognized the reality, then they may get politically active in a constructive way. But where is that catalyst going to come from? Are they going to listen to a black president?
Well, I think it's maybe a black president. I think really there needs to be some kind of alternative political party. I think both the Democrat and the Republican Party tend to be more influenced by kind of the winners of the economic game. And I feel like even though Obama is a black president, he's very much, and his rhetoric tends to focus on what he calls the middle class rather than looking at the fact that, you know, our study shows 4 out of 5, they may be members of the middle class part of the time, but they're actually not doing well. They're not members of the middle class for great parts of their lives. So I think that a new kind of discussion is needs to happen in the country that really is based on the reality of people's experience and more common things that they haven't that people have.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Herschel, who's the director of the Population and Development Program and a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. He just co-authored a new report at the Associated Press on the widening gap of wealth inequality in the United States, where 4 out of 5 adults are struggling with joblessness and near poverty. And in your study, you have the index of economic insecurity. I just mentioned that's engulfing 76% of white adults by the time they're 60, and the gauge defines economic insecurity as a year or more of periodic joblessness, reliance on government aid, such as food stamps, etc., and an income below 150% of the poverty line measured across all races. And if you do that, the risk of economic insecurity rises to 79%. So this is a stunning statistic, and I guess the reason that we don't recognize the reality of poverty and how pervasive it is with working Americans, I think it's a better term than certainly the present middle-class Americans, is that starting with Reagan, incomes have not gone up. They've been flat since the Carter administration, and that what the establishment, for the want of a better description, have done, starting under Reagan and accelerating with Alan Greenspan, was that they made credit incredibly available for working Americans to give them the illusion that their standard of living, while their wages were flat, to give them the illusion that their standard of living was raising, making credit available where the banks get their money for what, less than 1% from the Fed, and they charge it back at 18.5%. And then you've got the Walmart factor, where all this cheap stuff from China is, you can go and buy that. So you feel like you're still in the middle class by being able to shop on borrowed money, right? Is that what's kept the illusion?
I think that, yeah. There's definitely a game that's being played. I think it actually goes back to the early 1970s. Our study begins in 1968, and we've kind of captured this period. And this period of time has been a period of actually the top end of the income distribution has been monopolizing a greater share of the total income through rising affluence. And so you have a lot of people. It was actually rather uncommon for people to make more than $200,000 a year when our study started. That's been going up quite steadily. So you have a group of about 10 to 20% of the country that's experiencing rising wealth and income, and then the bottom 70 to 80% are experiencing, or they're stagnating, as you suggested, which is the majority. And I think that you're right that people are able to borrow and to get their kids to college on borrowed money, to borrow to pay for to use their house as a kind of an ATM, that there are schemes going on, but those things are wearing thin now. And I think we're starting to reach a position where people are not going to be able to go forward as easily as before. This has been going on for, 30, 40 years. So I think we're kind of coming to a day of reckoning when the people at the bottom need to have the rules of the game need to be changed. And I think it's difficult for politicians to really make that happen, given the way the politics is conducted in the country right now. And so I think some new kind of, something like the Green Party or some alternative political formation needs to begin to start to have a voice in the discourse so that people can start to address situations from where they're at rather than from where they're projected in the public discourse as it's constituted right now.
And just adding insult to injury, you have the new phenomenon of student debt. So the young kids getting an education, pay for it on loans, which they have to pay back, and now the interest rates doubled on federal loans, and they get more and more indentured as their less and less job prospects emerge. And if you just watch what's just happened in with the bankruptcy of the city of Detroit, you recognize that the notion of a social contract in this country is absolutely, compared to the social democracies in Europe and Australia and elsewhere, is just shocking. It's never really had been there. But now what left of it is being eviscerated, and the pensioners and the public employees in in Detroit are going to lose their pensions. Meanwhile, the city of Detroit is fully funding a $400 million arena for the Detroit Red Wings. So,
yeah, for hockey.
There you have the priorities of government today to take care of the people who take care of the politicians. I mean, I guess at the heart of it.
That's exactly it. That's it. That's it. You nailed it, Ian. I really think that's an important point. And I think the problem is that the people, the 4 out of 5 Americans that are experiencing hardship, they don't really have an organized voice that's in the discourse. And I think people need to think about things before they act. And we can't think about things until we can talk them over, write about them, you know, put them on blogs. I mean, there appears to be lots of freedom on the Internet to say these things, but I think actually discourse is relatively constrained by the more privileged elements of society. And so it's very, very difficult to do this, and I think we need voice to change the direction of the country and somehow. I mean, I think we have a situation where we have, you know, a robot can make a car, but a robot can't buy a car. I mean, that's really, I think, a good problem to have. We just need to get the robots working in the public interest and have some kind of society that produces for everyone, not just for the 5-10% that are benefiting.
So how can our audience get hold of this new study that you and your colleagues have done for the Associated Press?
Well, our study is being published as a book next year by Oxford University Press. We did the work the last year or so, and it's coming out as a book with Professor Mark Rank and myself. And so that will be available commercially next year. The study is kind of an advanced look at some of our findings in the study, where we look at not just the poverty, but also the wealth of America. And we also really talk to people a lot. We do a lot of interviews to really try to understand how people are processing their experience, because I think that's really important. It's not just about numbers. It's also about what people think and what they're feeling, and trying to gauge that and get a sense of how to move forward.
But what's happening in America is that the racial and class divides are being stirred up, arguably by the same establishment that's stealing the country blind. Meanwhile, the people, the 80% who are getting shafted, are being distracted by this and not getting together and forming a more perfect union to participate in the American dream that was promised to them.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. That's why our title is about chasing the dream, because I don't think that we've really caught up with it yet. I think we're still chasing it, and I think that we can catch it because we are the majority right now. We're 4 out of 5, and I think that it's within our grasp, but we have to so we need to begin communicating in new ways and to begin organizing in new ways to turn the country around, I guess.
So what can if people can't get your book now, what are the I guess they can this is at the Associated Press, this digest of the study, right?
That's right. There is a report which has some of the numbers from one of our chapters at the Associated Press.
Okay. Well, I thank you for joining us. I mean, I think this is some of the most important things. And of course, we know that there's a huge battle over the debt ceiling that's going to be coming up. We'll visit that again. And of course, the president's now finally given up on talking about this complete distraction known as the deficit, which has always been a ruse to cut taxes on the rich. Now,
exactly.
Now at least he's starting to talk about the real economy, the one that you've talked about with 80% of Americans, 4 or 5 living in poverty. Well, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Herschel, the director of the Population Development Program and a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. He has just authored a new report at the Associated Press on the widening gap of wealth inequality in the United States, where 4 out of 5 adults are struggling with joblessness and near poverty. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.